The mist rolled through the crypt, flowing along the floor, walls and ceiling. It poured up the steps and along a tunnel, the billows boiling ahead on one another as though engaged in a war. An unwary rat creeping across the flagstones was too late. The mist flowed over it. There was a squeak, cut off, and when the mist had gone, a few small white bones were all that remained. Some equally small bones, but fully assembled and wearing a black hooded robe and carrying a tiny scythe, appeared out of nowhere and walked over to them. Skeletal claws tippy-tapped on the stone.
"Squeak," said the ghost of the rat pathetically.
"Squeak,"
said the death of rats. This was all it really needed to know.
"You wanted to know where I'd put myself," said Granny. "I didn't go anywhere. I just put it in something alive and you took it. You invited me in. I'm in every muscle in your body and I'm in your head. Oh, yes. I was in the blood, Count. In the blood. I ain't been vampired. You've been weatherwaxed, all of you. And you've always listened to your blood, haven't you?"
The Count stared at her, open-mouthed. The spoon dropped out of her saucer and tinkled onto the floor, raising a wave in a thin white mist. It was rolling in from the walls, leaving a shrinking circle of black and white tiles in the middle of which were the vampires. Igor pushed his way through the crowd until he was alongside Nanny.
"It's all right," he said. "I couldn't let it go on. It was disgraceful."
The mist rose in a boiling tower. There was a moment of discontinuity, a feeling of sliced time, and then a figure stood behind Vlad and Lacrimosa. He was rather taller than most men, and wearing evening dress that might have been in style once upon a time. His hair was streaked with grey and brushed back over his ears in a way that gave the impression his head had been designed for its aerodynamic efficiency. Beautifully manicured hands gripped the shoulders of the younger vampires. Lacrimosa turned to scratch him and cowered when he snarled like a tiger. Then the face returned to something closer to human, and the newcomer smiled. He seemed genuinely pleased to see everyone.
"Good morning," he said.
"Another bloody vampire," said Nanny.
"Not any old vampire," said Igor, hopping from one foot to the other. "It's the old master. Old Red Eyes is back."
Granny stood up, ignoring the tall figure firmly holding the two suddenly docile vampires. She advanced on the Count.
"I know all about what you can and can't do," she said, "because you let me in. And that means you can't do what I can't do. And you think just like me. The difference being I've done it longer and I'm better than you at it." "You're meat," snarled the Count. "Clever meat." "And you invited me in," said Granny. "I'm not the sort to go where I'm not welcome, I'm sure."
In the Count's arms, the baby started to cry. He stood up.
"How sure are you that I won't harm this child?" he said. "I wouldn't, so you can't."
The Count's face contorted as he wrestled with his feelings, and also with Magrat, who was kicking him on the shins.
"It could have worked," he said, and for the first time the certainty had been drained from his voice.
"You mean it could have worked for you?" shouted Agnes.
"We are vampires. We cannot help what we are."
"Only animals can't help what they are," said Granny. "Will you give me the child now?"
"If I..."
the Count began and then straightened up.
"No. I don't have to bargain. I can fight you, just as you fought me. And if I walk out of here now, I don't think there's anyone who'll dare stop me. Look at you, all of you, and look at me. And now look at him."
He nodded at the figure holding Vlad and Lacrimosa as still as statues.
"Is that what you want?"
"Sorry, who is this we're supposed to be looking at?" said Granny.
"Oh, Eagle's old master, the old Count Magpier, I believe."
The old Count nodded gracefully.
"Your servant, madam," he said.
"I doubt it," said Granny.
"Oh, no one minded him," said Piotr from among the escrow citizens. "He only ever came round every few years, and anyway, if you remembered about the garlic, he wasn't a problem. He didn't expect us to like him."
The old Count smiled at him.
"You look familiar. One of the Ravi family, aren't you?"
"Piotr, sir, son of Hans."
"Ah, yes. Very similar bone structure. Do remember me to your grandmother."
"She passed away 10 years ago, sir."
"Oh, really? I am so sorry. Time goes so quickly when you're dead."
The old master sighed.
"A very fine figure in a nightdress, as I recall."
He was all right, said someone else in the crowd. We got a nip every now and again, but we got over it.
That's a familiar voice, said the vampire. Are you a Vezen?
Yes, sir.
Related to Arno Vezen?
Great-granddaddy, sir.
Good man. Killed me stone dead 75 years ago. Stake right through the heart from 20 paces. You should be proud.
The man in the crowd beamed with ancestral pride.
We've still got the stake hung up over the fireplace, Your Honour, he said.
Well done, good man. I like to see the old ways kept up.
Count Magpier screamed.
You can't possibly prefer that! He's a monster!
But he never made an appointment, shouted Agnes, even louder. I bet he never thought it was all just an arrangement.
Count Magpier was edging towards the door with his hostages.
No, he said. This is not how it's going to happen. If anyone really believes that I won't harm my charming hostages, perhaps you will try to stop me. Does anyone really believe that old woman?
Nanny Og opened her mouth, caught Granny's eye and shut it again. The crowd parted behind the count as he dragged Magrat towards the door. He walked into the figure of Mightily Oates.
Have you ever thought of letting Om into your life? Said the priest.
His voice trembled. His face glistened with sweat.
Oh, you again, said the count. If I can resist her, little boy, you are not a problem.
Oates held his axe before him as if it was made of some rare and delicate metal.
Begone, foul fiend, he began.
Oh, dear me, said the count, thrusting the axe aside. And don't you learn anything, you stupid man, little stupid man who has a little stupid faith in a little stupid god?
But it lets me see things as they are,
Oates managed.
Really? And you think you can stand in my way? An axe isn't even a holy symbol.
Oh, Oates looked crestfallen. Agnes saw his shoulders sag as he lowered the blade. Then he looked up, smiled brightly, and said,
Let's make it so.
Agnes saw the blade leave a gold trail in the air as it swept around. There was a soft, almost silken sound. The axe dropped onto the flagstones. In a sudden silence it clanged like a bell. Then Oates reached out and snatched the child from the vampire's unresisting hands. He held her out to Magrat, who took her in shocked silence. The first sound after that was the rustle of Granny's dress as she stood up and walked over to the axe. She nudged it with her foot.
If I've got a fault, she said, contriving to suggest that this was only a theoretical possibility, it's not knowing when to turn and run, and I tends to bluff on a weak hand.
Her voice echoed in the hall. No one else had even breathed out yet. She nodded at the count, who'd slowly raised his hands to the red wound that ran all around his neck.
It was a sharp axe, she said. Who says there's no mercy in the world? Just don't nod, that's all. And someone'll take you down to a nice cold coffin, and I dare say 50 years'll just fly past, and maybe you'll wake with enough sense to be stupid.
There was a murmur from the mob as they came back to life. Granny shook her head.
They want you deader than that, I see, she said, as the count gazed ahead of him with frozen, desperate eyes, and the blood welled and seeped between his fingers. And there's ways. Oh, yes. We could burn you to ashes and scatter them in the sea.
This met with a general sigh of approval.
Or throw them up in the air in the middle of a gale.
This got a smattering of applause.
Or just pay some sailor to drop you over the edge.
This even got a few whistles.
Of course you'd come back alive again, I suppose, one day. But just floating in space for millions of years. Oh, that sounds very boring to me.
She raised a hand to silence the crowd.
Now, 50 years to think about things, that's about right. People need vampires, she said. They help them remember what steaks and garlic are for.
She snapped her fingers at the crowd.
Come on, two of you take him down to the vaults. Show some respect for the dead.
That's not enough, said Piotr, stepping forward. Not after all he...
Then when he comes back, you deal with him yourself, snapped Granny loudly. Teach your children. Don't trust the cannibal just because he's using a knife and fork. And remember that vampires don't go where they're not invited.
They backed away. Granny relaxed a little.
This time round, it's up to me. My choice.
She leaned closer to the count's horrible grimace.
You tried to take my mind away from me, she said in a lower voice, and that's everything to me. Reflect on that. Try to learn.
She stood back.
Take him away.
She turned away to the tall figure.
"So, you're the old master, are you?" she said.
"Alison Weatherwax," said the old master. "I have a good memory for necks."
Granny froze for a second.
"What?"
"No.
How do you know the name?"
"Why, she passed through here, 50 years ago? We met briefly, and then she cut off my head and stuck a stake in my heart."
The Count sighed happily.
"A very spirited woman. You're a relative, I presume? I lose track of generations, I'm afraid."
"Granddaughter," said Granny weakly.
"There's a phoenix outside the castle, Igor tells me."
"It'll leave, I expect."
The Count nodded.
"I've always rather liked them," he said wistfully. "There were so many of them when I was young. They made the nights pretty, so pretty. Everything was so much simpler then."
His voice trailed off and then came back louder.
"But now, apparently, we're in modern times."
"That's what they say," murmured Granny.
"Well, madam, I've never taken too much notice of them. 50 years later, they never seem so modern as all that."
He shook the younger vampires like dolls.
"I do apologize for my nephew's behavior. Quite out of keeping for a vampire. Would you people from Escrow like to kill these two? It's the least I could do."
"Ain't they your relatives?"
said Nanny Ogg as the crowd surged forward.
"Oh, yes. But we've never been much of a species for playing happy families."
Vlad looked imploringly at Agnes and reached out to her. "You wouldn't let them kill me, would you? You wouldn't let them do this to me. We could have... We might...
You wouldn't, would you?"
The crowd hesitated. This sounded like an important plea. 100 pairs of eyes stared at Agnes. She took his hand.
"I suppose we could work on him," said Perdita.
But Agnes thought about Escrow, and the queues, and the children playing while they waited, and how evil might come animal sharp in the night, or greyly by day on a list. "Vlad," she said gently, looking deep into his eyes, "I'd even hold their coats."
"A fine sentiment, but that ain't happening," said Granny behind her. "You take 'em away, Count. Teach 'em the old ways. Teach 'em stupidity."
The Count nodded and grinned toothily.
"Certainly. I shall teach them that to live, you have to rise again."
"Eh, you don't live, Count. The phoenix lives. You just don't know you're dead. Now get along with you."
There was another moment sliced out of time, and then a flock of magpies rose up from where the three vampires had been, screaming and chattering, and disappeared in the darkness of the roof.
"There's hundreds of them," said Agnes to Nanny.
"Well, vampires can turn into things," said Nanny. "Everyone knows that who knows anything about vampires."
"And what do 300 magpies mean?"
"They mean it's time to put covers on all the furniture," said Nanny, "and that it's time for me to have a very big drink."
The crowd began to break up, aware that the big show was over.
"Why didn't she just let us wipe them out?" hissed Piotr by Agnes's ear. "Death's too good for them."
"Yes," said Agnes. "I suppose that's why she didn't let them have it."
Oates hadn't moved. He was still staring straight ahead of him, but his hands were shaking. Agnes led him gently to a bench and eased him down.
"I killed him, didn't I?"
he whispered.
"Sort of," said Agnes. "It's a bit hard to tell with vampires. There was just nothing else to do. Everything just went, the air just went gold, and there was just this one moment to, do something."
"I don't think anyone's complaining," said Agnes.
"You've got to admit he's quite attractive," whispered Perdita, "if only he'd do something about that boil."
Magrat sat down on the other side of Oates, clutching the baby. She breathed deeply a few times.
"That was very brave of you," she said.
"No, it wasn't," said Oates hoarsely. "I thought Mistress Weatherwax was going to do something."
"She did," said Magrat, shivering.
"Oh, she did."
Granny Weatherwax sat down on the other end of the bench and pinched the bridge of her nose.
"I just want to go home now," she said. "I just want to go home and sleep for a week."
She yawned.
"Oh, I'm dying for a cuppa."
"I thought you'd made one," said Agnes. "You had us slavering for it."
"Where'd I get tea here? It was just some mud in water. But I know Nanny keeps a bag of it somewhere on her person."
She yawned again.
"Make the tea, Magrat."
Agnes opened her mouth, but Magrat waved her into silence and then handed her the baby.
"Certainly, Granny," she said, gently pushing Agnes back into her seat. "I'll just find out where Igor keeps the kettle, shall I?"
Mightily Oates stepped out onto the battlements. The sun was well up and a breeze was blowing in over the forests of Uberwald. A few magpies chattered in the trees nearest the castle. Granny was leaning with her elbows on the wall, staring out over the thinning mists.
"It looks like it's going to be a fine day," said Oates happily, and he did feel happy to his amazement.
There was sharpness to the air, and the sense of the future brimming with possibilities. He remembered the moment when he'd swung the axe, when both of him had swung it together. Perhaps there was a way.
"There's a storm coming down from the hub later," said Granny.
"Well, at least that'll be good for the crops then," said Oates.
Something flickered overhead. In the new daylight, the wings of the phoenix were hard to see, mere yellow shimmers in the air, with the tiny shape of the little hawk in the centre as it circled high over the castle.
"Why would anyone want to kill something like that?" said Oates.
"Oh, some people will kill anything for the fun of it."
"Is it a true bird, or is it something that exists within a bird?"
"It's a thing, that is," said Granny sharply. "Don't go spilling allegory all down your shirt."
"Well, I feel blessed to have seen it."
"Really?" "I generally feel the same about the sunrise," said Granny. "You would too at my time of life."
She sighed and then seemed to be speaking mainly to herself.
"She never went to the bad then, whatever people said. And you'd have to be on your toes with that old vampire. She never went to the bad.
You heard him say that, right? He said it. He didn't have to."
Yes. "She'd have been older than me too. Bloody good witch she was, Nana Allison. Sharp as a knife. Had her funny little ways, of course, but who hasn't?"
"No one I know, certainly."
"Right, you're right," Granny straightened up.
"Good," she said.
Yes?
Oates was looking down at the drawbridge and the road to the castle.
"There's a man in a nightshirt covered in mud and waving a sword down there," he said, "followed by a lot of Lancre people and some, little blue men."
He looked down again.
"At least it looks like mud," he added.
"That'll be the king," said Granny. "Big Aggie's given him some of her bros, by the sound of it. He'll save the day."
Hasn't the day been saved?"
"Oh, he's the king. It looks like it might be a nice day, so let him save it. You've got to give kings something to do. Anyway, after a drink from Big Aggie, he won't know what day it is. We'd better get down there."
"I feel I should thank you," said Oates, when they reached the spiral staircase.
"For helping you across the mountains, you mean?"
"The world is, different."
Oates's gaze went out across the haze and the forests and the purple mountains.
"Everywhere I look, I see something holy."
For the first time since he'd met her, he saw Granny Weatherwax smile properly. Normally her mouth went up at the corners just before something unpleasant was going to happen to someone who deserved it. But this time she appeared to be pleased with what she'd heard.
"That's a start, then," she said.
The Magpie's coach had been righted and dragged up to the castle. Now it returned with Jason Ogg at the reins. He was concentrating on avoiding the bumps. They made his bruises tender. Besides, the royal family was on board and he was feeling extremely loyal at the moment. Jason Ogg was very big and very strong, and therefore not a violent man, because he did not need to be. Sometimes he was summoned down to the pub to sort out the mere serious fights, which he usually did by picking up both contestants and holding them apart until they stopped struggling. If that didn't work, he'd bang them together a few times, in as friendly a way as possible. Aggressiveness did not normally impress him, but since in yesterday's battle at Lancre Castle, he'd had to physically lift Verence off the ground in order to stop him slaughtering enemies, friends, furniture, walls, and his own feet, he was certainly seeing his king in a new light. It had turned out to be an extremely short battle. The mercenaries had been only too keen to surrender, especially after Sean's assault. The real fight had been to keep Verence away from them long enough to allow them to say so. Jason was impressed. King Verence, inside the coach, laid his head in his wife's lap and groaned as she wiped his brow with a cloth. At a respectable distance, the coach was followed by a cart containing the witches, although what it contained mostly was snore. Granny Weatherwax had a primal snore. It had never been tamed. No one had ever had to sleep next to it, to curb its wilder excesses by means of a kick, a prod in the small of the back,
or a pillow used as a bludgeon. It had had years in a lonely bedroom to perfect the unimpeded by the nudges, jabs, and occasional attempts at murder that usually moderate the snore impulse over time. She sprawled in the straw at the bottom of the cart, mouth open, and snored. "You half expect to find the shafts sawed through, don't you?" said Nanny, who was leading the horse. "Still, you can hear it doing her good." "I'm a bit worried about Mr. Oates, though," said Agnes. "He's just sitting there and grinning." Oates was sitting with his legs over the tail of the cart, staring happily at the sky. "Did he hit his head?" said Nanny. "I don't think so." "Let him be, then. At least he ain't setting fire to anything. Oh, here's an old friend." Igor, tongue protruding from the corner of his mouth in the ferocity of his concentration, was putting the finishing touches to a new sign. It read, "Why not visit our gifty shoppy?" He stood up and nodded as the cart drew near. "The old master came up with some new ideas while he was dead," he said, feeling that some explanation was called for. "This afternoon I've got to start building a fun fair, whatever that is." "That's basically swings," said Nanny. Igor brightened up. "Oh, I've plenty of rope, and I've always been a dab hand at nooses," he said. "No, that's not..." Agnes began, but Nanny Og cut in quickly. "I suppose it all depends on who's going to have the fun," she said. "We'll be seeing you, Igor. Don't do anything I wouldn't do if you ever find anything I wouldn't do." "We're very sorry about Scraps," said Agnes. "Perhaps we can find you a puppy, or..."
"Thanks all the same, but no. There's only one Scraps."
He waved to them until they were round the next bend. As Agnes turned round again, she saw the three magpies. They were perched on a branch over the road. "Three for a funeral?" she began. A stone whirred up. There was an indignant squawk and a shower of feathers.
"Two for mirth," said Nanny, in a self-satisfied voice.
"Nanny, that was cheating."
"Witches always cheat," said Nanny Og.
She glanced back at the sleeping figure behind them. "Everyone knows that who knows anything about witches." They went home to Lancre. It had been raining again. Water had seeped into Oates's tent, and also into the harmonium, which now emitted an occasional squashed frog burp when it was played. The songbooks also smelled rather distressingly of a cat. He gave up on them and turned to the task of disassembling his camp bed, which had skinned two knuckles and crushed one finger when he put it up, and still looked as though it was designed for a man shaped like a banana. Oates was aware that he was trying to avoid thinking. On the whole, he was happy with this. There was something pleasing about simply getting on with simple tasks and listening to his own breath. Perhaps there was a way. From outside, there was the faint sound of something wooden hitting something hollow and whispering on the evening air. He peered through the tent flap. People were filing stealthily into the field. The first few were carrying planks. Several were pushing barrels. He stood with his mouth open as the very rough benches were constructed and began to fill up. A number of the men had bandages across their noses, he noticed. Then he heard the rattle of wheels and saw the royal coach lurch through the gateway. This woke him up, and he scurried back into the tent, pulling damp clothes out of his bag in a frantic search for a clean shirt. His hat had never been found, and his coat was caked with mud. The leather of his shoes was cracked, and the buckles had instantly tarnished in the acid marshes. But surely, a clean shirt. Someone tried to knock on the damp canvas, and then after an interval of half a second stepped into the tent.
"Are you decent?" said Nanny Og, looking him up and down. "We're all out here waiting, you know. Lost sheep waiting to be shorn, you might say," she added,
her manner suggesting very clearly that she was doing something that she personally disapproved of, but doing it just the same. Oates turned around.
"Mrs. Og, I know you don't, like me very much."
"Don't see why I should like you at all," said Nanny, "what with you tagging after Esme and her having to help you all the way across the mountains like that."
The response was screaming up Oates's throat before he noticed the faint, knowing look in Nanny's eyes, and he managed to turn it into a cough.
yes, he said. "Yes. Silly of me, wasn't it? How many are out there, Mrs. Og?"
"Only 100, maybe 150.
"Levers," thought Oates, and had a fleeting vision of the pictures in Nanny's parlour. "She controls the levers of a lot of people, but someone pulled her lever first, I'll bet. And what do they expect of me?"
"Says even song on the poster," said Nanny simply. "Even beer would be better."
So he went out and saw the watching faces of a large part of Lunker's population lined up in the late afternoon light. The King and Queen were in the front row. Verence nodded regally at Oates to signal that whatever it was that he intended ought to start around now. It was clear from the body language of Nanny Ogg that any specifically Omnian prayers would not be tolerated, and Oates made do with a generic prayer of thanks to any god that might be listening, and even to the ones who weren't. Then he pulled out the stricken harmonium and tried a few chords until Nanny elbowed him aside, rolled up her sleeves and coaxed notes out of the damp bellows that Oates never even knew were in there. The singing wasn't very enthusiastic, though, until Oates tossed aside the noisome songbook and taught them some of the songs he remembered from his grandmother, full of fire and thunder and death and justice, and tunes you could actually whistle, with titles like Om Shall Trample the Ungodly, and Lift Me Up to the Skies, and Light the Good Light. They went down well. Lonker people weren't too concerned about religion, but they knew what it ought to sound like. While he led the singing, with the aid of a long stick and the words of the hymns scrawled on the side of his tent, he scanned his, well, he decided to call it, his congregation. It was his first real one. There were plenty of women and a lot of very well-scrubbed men, but one face was patently not there. Its absence dominated the scene. But as he raised his eyes upwards in mid-song, he did notice an eagle far overhead, a mere speck gyrating across the darkening sky, possibly hunting for lost lambs. And then it was over, and people left quietly, with the look of those who'd done a job which had not been unpleasant, but which was nevertheless over. The collection plate produced 2 pennies, some carrots, a large onion, a small loaf, a pound of mutton, a jug of milk, and a pickled pig's trotter.
"We're not really a cash economy," said King Verence, stepping forward.
He had a bandage across his forehead.
"Oh, it'll make a good supper, sire," said Oates, in the madly cheerful voice that people use when addressing royalty.
"Surely you'll dine with us," said Magrat.
I was planning to leave at first light, sire, so I really ought to spend the evening packing and setting fire to the camp bed.
"Leaving? But I thought you were staying here. I've taken community soundings," said the King, "and I think I can say that popular opinion is with me on this."
Oates looked at Magrat's face, which said plainly, "Granny doesn't object."
"Well, I expect I shall pass through again, sire," he said. "But to tell you the truth, I was thinking of heading on to Uberwald."
"That's a hellish place, Mr. Oates."
"I've thought about it all day, sire, and I'm set on it."
"Oh."
Verence looked nonplussed, but King's learned to swing back upright.
"I'm sure you know your own mind best."
He swayed slightly as Magrat's elbow grazed his ribs.
"Oh, yes. We heard you lost your holy amulet, and so this afternoon we, that is to say, the Queen and Miss Knit, got Sean Ogg to make this in the mint."
Oates unwrapped the black velvet scroll. Inside, on a golden chain, was a small golden double-headed axe. He stared at it.
"Sean isn't very good at turtles," said Magrat, to fill the gap.
"I shall treasure it," said Oates at last.
"Of course, we appreciate it's not very holy," said the King.
Oates waved a hand dismissively.
"Who knows, sire? Holiness is where you find it," he said.
Behind the King, Jason and Darren Ogg were standing respectfully to attention. Both still had plasters stuck across their noses. They moved aside hurriedly to make way for the King, who didn't seem to notice. Nanny Ogg struck a chord on the harmonium when the royal couple had departed with their retinue.
"If you drop into our Jason's forge first thing when you're leaving, I'll see to it he fixes the bellows on this contraption," she said diffidently,
and Oates realised that in the context of Nanny Ogg, this was as close as he was going to get to 3 rousing cheers and the grateful thanks of the population.
"I was so impressed that everyone turned up of their own free will," he said, spontaneously, as it were. "Don't push your luck, sonny boy," said Nanny, getting up. "Nice to have met you, Mrs. Ogg."
Nanny walked away a few steps, but Ogg's never left anything unsaid.
"I can't say as I approve of you," she said stiffly, "but should you ever come knocking on an Ogg door in these parts, you'll get a hot meal. You're too skinny. I've seen more meat on a butcher's pencil."
"Thank you.
Not necessarily pudding as well, mark you."
of course not. Well then, Nanny Og shrugged. Best of luck in Uberwald, then. Om will go with me, I'm sure, said Oates. He was interested in how annoyed you could make Nanny by speaking calmly to her, and wondered if Granny Weatherwax had tried it.
I hope he does, said Nanny. I personally don't want him hanging around here.
When she'd gone, Oates lit a fire of the horrible bed and stuck the songbooks around it to dry out. Hello. The thing about a witch in darkness is that all you see is her face, bobbing towards you, surrounded by black. Then a little contrast reasserted itself, and an area of shadow detached from the rest and became Agnes.
Good evening, said Oates. Thank you for coming. I've never heard anyone singing in harmony with themselves before.
Agnes coughed nervously.
Are you really going on into Uberwald? There's no reason to stay here, is there?
Agnes's left arm twitched a few times. She steadied it with her right hand.
Suppose not, she said in a small voice. Now shut up, this is not the time.
I beg your pardon?
I was just talking to myself, said Agnes wretchedly. Look, everyone knows you helped Granny. They just pretend they don't.
Yes, I, know.
You don't mind?
Oates shrugged. Agnes coughed.
I thought perhaps you were going to stay on here for a while.
There'd be no point. I'm not needed here.
I shouldn't think vampires and so on would be very keen on singing hymns, said Agnes quietly.
Perhaps they can learn something else, said Oates.
I shall see what may be done.
Agnes stood hesitantly for a few moments.
I've got to give you this, she said, suddenly handing over a small bag.
Oates reached inside and took out a small jar. Inside, a phoenix feather burned, lighting up the field with a clear, cool light.
It's from... Agnes began.
I know who it's from, said Oates.
Is Mistress Weatherwax all right?
I didn't see her here.
She's having a rest today.
Well, thank her from me, will you?
She said it's to take into dark places.
Oates laughed.
Yes. Well, I might come and see you off in the morning,
said Agnes uncertainly.
That would be nice of you. So, until, you know.
Yes. Agnes seemed to be struggling with some inner resistance. Then she said,
And, there's something I've been meaning to... I mean, perhaps you could,
Yes? Agnes's right hand dived urgently into her pocket and she pulled out a small package wrapped in greased paper.
It's a poultice, she blurted out. It's a very good recipe, and the book says it always works, and if you heat it up and leave it on it, it'll do wonders for your boil.
Oates took it gently.
It's just possible that's the nicest thing anyone's ever given me, he said. Good. It's from, both of us. Goodbye.
Oates watched her leave the circle of light, and then something drew his eye upwards again. The circling eagle had risen above the shadow of the mountains and into the light of the setting sun. For a moment it flashed gold, and then dropped into the dark again. From up here, the eagle could see for miles across the mountains. Over Uberwald, the threatened storm had broken. Lightning scribbled across the sky. Some of it cracked around the highest tower of Don't Go Near the castle, and on the rain hat that Igor wore to stop his head rusting. It raised little balls of glowing light on the big telescopic iron spike, as taking care to stand on his portable rubber mat, he patiently wound it upwards. At the foot of the apparatus, which was already humming with high tension, was a bundle wrapped in a blanket. The spike locked itself into position. Igor sighed and waited.
All right, look. Fetch. Fetch. There we go.
Death watched Scraps bound away. He wasn't used to this. It wasn't that people weren't sometimes glad to see him, because the penultimate moments of life were often crowded and complex, and a cool figure in black came as something of a relief. But he'd never encountered quite this amount of enthusiasm, or if it came to it, this amount of flying mucus. It was disconcerting. It made him feel he wasn't doing his job properly.
There's a satisfactory dog. Now, drop. Let go, please. Did you hear me say let go? Let go this minute.
Scraps bounced away. This was far too much fun to end. There was a soft chiming from within his robe.
Death rubbed his hand on the cloth in an effort to get it dry, and brought out a lifetimer, its sand all pooled in the bottom bulb. But the glass itself was misshapen, twisted, covered in welts of raised glass, and as Death watched, it filled up with crackling blue light. Normally, Death was against this sort of thing, but he reasoned as he snapped his fingers, at the moment it looked as though it was the only way he'd get his scythe back. The lightning hit. There was a smell of singed wool. Igor waited a while, and then trudged around to the bundle, trailing molten rubber behind him. Kneeling down, he carefully unwrapped the blanket. Scraps yawned. A large tongue licked Igor's hand. As he smiled with relief, there came from far down below in the castle the sound of a mighty organ playing toccata for young women in underwired nightdresses. The eagle swooped on into the bowl of Lancre. The long light glowed on the lake, and on the big V-shaped ripple, made up of many small V-shaped ripples, that arrowed through the water towards the unsuspecting island. The voices echoed around the mountains.
"See you, Otter! Taggy Jins MacLady! We freemen, Mac MacFeagle!"
The eagle passed overhead, dropping fast and steep now. It drifted silently over the shadowy woods, curved over the trees, and landed suddenly on a branch beside a cottage in a clearing. Granny Weatherwax awoke. Her body did not move, but her gaze darted this way and that sharply, and in the gloom her nose looked more hooked than normal. Then she settled back, and her shoulders lost the hunch-perching look. After a while she stood up, stretched, and went to the doorway. The night felt warmer. She could feel greenness in the ground, uncoiling. The year was past the edge, heading away from the dark. Of course, dark would come again, but that was in the nature of the world. Many things were beginning. When at last she'd shut the door, she lit the fire, took the box of candles out of the dresser, and lit every single one, and put them around the room in saucers. On the table, the pool of water that had accumulated in the last 2 days rippled and rose gently in the middle. Then a drip soared upwards and plopped into the damp patch in the ceiling. Granny wound up the clock and started the pendulum. She left the room for a moment and came back with a square of cardboard attached to a loop of elderly string. She sat down in the rocking chair and reached down into the hearth for a stick of half-burned wood. The clock ticked as she wrote. Another drop left the table and plunged towards the ceiling. Then Granny Weatherwax hung the sign around her neck and lay back with a smile. The chair rocked for a while, a counterpoint to the dripping of the table and the ticking of the clock, and then slowed. The sign read, "I still ain't dead." The light faded from can to can't. After a few minutes, an owl woke up in a nearby tree and sailed out over the forests. That is the end of Carpe Jugulum. It was written by Terry Pratchett and read by Nigel Planer.